Hello, everyone. We're continuing on with Thomas Watson's Ten Commandments. We're still in the introduction and still going through the preface. And he's been going through the verse, I'm the Lord thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt, and out of the house of bondage. And now we're on out of the house of bondage. So we'll plan to start that this reading. And it's planned to be divided into two readings because it's about that long. So out of the house of bondage. Egypt and the house of bondage are the same, only they are expressed under a different notion. By Egypt is meant a place of idolatry and superstition. By the house of bondage is meant a place of affliction. Israel, while in Egypt, were under great tyranny. They had cruel taskmasters set over them, who put them to hard labor and set them to make bricks, yet allowed them no straw. Therefore, Egypt is called in Deuteronomy 4:20, the iron furnace, and here the house of bondage. From this expression, I brought thee out of the house of bondage, two things are to be noted. God's children may sometimes be under sore afflictions in the house of bondage, but God will, in due time, bring them out of their afflicted state. I brought thee out of the house of bondage. God's children may sometimes be under sore afflictions in the house of bondage. God's people have to writ of ease granted them. Have no writ of ease granted them, no charter of exemption from trouble in this life. While the wicked are kept in sugar, the godly are often kept in brine. And indeed, how could God's power be seen in bringing them out of trouble if he did not sometimes bring them into it? Or how should God wipe away the tears from their eyes in heaven if on earth they had shed none? Doubtless, God sees there is need that his children should be sometimes in the house of bondage. If need be, ye are in heaviness, 1 Peter 1:6. The body sometimes needs a bitter portion more than a sweet one. Question, why does God let his people be in the house of bondage or in an afflicted state? He does it, number one, for probation or trial. Who led thee through that terrible wilderness that he might humble thee and prove thee? Deuteronomy 8:15 and 16. Affliction is the touchstone of sincerity. Thou, O God, hast proved us. Thou hast tried us as silver. Thou laidst affliction upon our loins. Psalm 66:10 and 11. Hypocrites may embrace the true religion in prosperity and court this queen while she has a jewel hung at her ear, but he is a good Christian who will keep close to God in a time of suffering. All this has come upon us, yet have we not forgotten thee. Psalm 44:17. To love God in heaven is no wonder, but to love him when he chastises us discovers sincerity. The second reason for purgation, or to purge our corruption. And this is all the fruit to take away his sin. Isaiah 28:9. The eye, though a tender part, yet when sore, we put sharp powders and waters into it to eat out the pearl. So though the people of God are dear to him, yet when corruption begins to grow in them, he will apply the sharp powder of affliction to eat out the pearl in the eye. Affliction is God's flail to thresh off the husks. It is a means God uses to purge out sloth, luxury, pride, and love of the world. God's furnace is in Zion, Isaiah 31:5. This is not to consume, but to refine. What if we have more afflictions, if by this means we have less sin? Number three, for augmentation, to increase the graces of the Spirit. Grace thrives most in the iron furnace. Sharp frosts nourish the corn, so sharp afflictions nourish grace. Grace in the saints is often as fire hid in the embers. Affliction is the bellows to blow it up into a flame. The Lord makes the house of bondage a friend to grace. Then faith and patience act their part. The darkness of the night cannot hinder the brightness of a star. So the more the diamond is cut, the more it sparkles, and the more God afflicts us, the more our graces cast a sparkling luster. Number 4, for preparation, to fit and prepare the saints for glory. 2 Corinthians 4:17. The stones which are cut out for a building are first hewn and squared. The godly are called living stones, 1 Peter 2:5. God first hews and polishes them by affliction, that they may be fit for the heavenly building. The house of bondage prepares for the house not made with hands, 2 Corinthians 5:1. The vessels of mercy are seasoned with affliction, and then the wine of glory is poured in. Question: how do the afflictions of the godly differ from the afflictions of the wicked? Number 1, they are but castigations, but those on the wicked are punishments. The one come from a father, the other from a judge. Number 2, afflictions on the godly are fruits of covenant mercy, 2 Samuel 7:14. Afflictions on the wicked are the effects of God's wrath. He hath much wrath with his sickness, Ecclesiastes 5:17. Afflictions on the wicked are the pledge and earnest of hell. They are like the pinioning of a malefactor, which presages his execution. Number 3, afflictions on the godly make them better, but afflictions on the wicked make them worse. The godly pray more, Psalm 130, verse 1. The wicked blaspheme more. Men were scorched with great heat and blasphemed the name of God, Revelation 16, 9. Afflictions on the wicked make them more impenitent. Every plague upon Egypt increased the plague of hardness in Pharaoh's heart. To what a prodigy of wickedness do some persons come after great sickness? Affliction on the godly is like bruising spices, which are most sweet and fragrant. Affliction on the wicked is like pounding weeds with a pestle, which makes them more unsavory. Use number 1. We are not to wonder to see Israel in the house of bondage, 1 Peter 4:12. The holiness of the saints will not excuse them from sufferings. Christ was the Holy One of God, yet he was in the iron furnace. His spouse is a lily among thorns, Canticles or Song of Solomon 2, verse 2. Though his sheep have an earmark of election upon them, yet they may have their wool fleeced off. The godly have some good in them, therefore the devil afflicts them, and some evil in them, therefore God afflicts them. So the godly have some good in them by God and his Spirit, therefore the devil afflicts them, and some have evil in them, and therefore God afflicts them. While there are two seeds in the world, expect to be under the black rod. The gospel tells us of reigning in power, but first of suffering, 2 Timothy 2, verse 12. And we all have that evil still in us with the carnal man, the body of flesh, and so God afflicts us, as for the reasons he already stated. Number 2, affliction is not always the sign of God's anger. Israel, the apple of God's eye, a peculiar treasure to him above all people, were in the house of bondage, Exodus 19:5. We are apt to judge and censor those who are in an afflicted state. When the barbarians saw the viper on Paul's hand, they said, "No doubt this man is a murderer," Acts 28:4. So when we see the viper of affliction fastened upon the godly, we are apt to censure them and say, "These are greater sinners than others, and God hates them." But this rash censuring is for want or lack of wisdom. Were not Israel in the house of bondage? Was not Jeremiah in the dungeon and Paul a night and day in the deep? God's afflicting is so far from evidencing hatred that his not afflicting does evidence hatred. "I will not punish your daughters when they commit whoredom," Hosea 4:14. God punishes most when he does not punish. His hand is heaviest when it seems to be lightest. The judge will not burn him in the hand whom he intends to execute. Number three, if God's own Israel may be in the house of bondage, then afflictions do not of themselves demonstrate a man miserable. Indeed, sin unrepented of makes one miserable, but the cross does not. If God has a design in afflicting his children to make them happy, they are not miserable. But God's afflicting them is to make them happy, therefore they are not miserable. Happy is the man whom God correcteth, Job 5:17. The world counts them happy who can keep out of affliction, but the scripture calls them happy who are afflicted. Question, how are they happy? Answer, because they are more holy, Hebrews 12:10. Because they are more in God's favor, Proverbs 3:12. The goldsmith loves his gold when in the furnace, even though it's being burned, because they have more of God's sweet presence. Psalm 91:15. They cannot be unhappy who have God's powerful presence in supporting and his gracious presence in sanctifying their affliction. Because the more affliction they have, the more degrees of glory they shall have. The lower they have been in the iron furnace, the higher they shall sit upon the throne of glory. The heavier their crosses, the heavier shall be their crowns. So then, if afflictions make a Christian happy, they cannot call him miserable. Number four, see the merciful providence of God to his children. Though they may be in the house of bondage and smart by affliction, yet they shall not be hurt by affliction. What hurt does the fan to the corn? It only separates the chaff from it, or the lance to the body. It only lets out the abscess. The house of bondage does that which sometimes ordinances will not. It humbles and reforms. If they be holden in cords of affliction, he openeth their ear to discipline and commandeth that they return from iniquity. Job 36:8-10. Oh, what a merciful providence is it that, though God bruise his people, yet while he is bruising them, he is doing them good. It is as if one should throw a bag of money at another, which bruises him a little, but yet it enriches him. Affliction enriches the soul and yields the sweet fruits of righteousness. Hebrews 12:11 of righteousness. Number five, if Israel be in the house of bondage, if the Lord deals so with his own children, then how severely will he deal with the wicked? If he be so severe with those he loves, how severe will he be with those he hates? If they do these things in a green tree, what shall be done in the dry? Luke 23:31. If they that pray and mourn for sin be so severely dealt with, what will become of those that swear and break the Sabbath and are unclean? If Israel be in the iron furnace, the wicked shall lie in the fiery furnace of hell. It should be the saddest news to wicked men to hear that the people of God are afflicted. Let them think how dreadful the case of sinners will be. Judgment must begin in the house of God, and if it first begin at us, what shall the end be of them that obey not the gospel? 1 Peter 4:17. If God thresh his wheat, he will burn the chaff. If the godly suffer castigation, the wicked shall suffer condemnation. If he mingle with his people's cup with wormwood, he will mingle the wicked's cup with fire and brimstone. Use number two. If Israel be in the house of bondage, number one, do not entertain too hard thoughts of affliction. Christians are apt to look upon the cross and the iron furnace as frightful things and do what they can to shun them. Nay, sometimes to avoid affliction, they run themselves into sin. But do not think too hardly of affliction, or think too hard that, or have hard thoughts against it. Do not look upon it as through the multiplying glass of fear. The house of bondage is not hell. Consider that affliction comes from a wise God who prescribes whatever befalls us. Persecutions are like apothecaries. They give us the physic or medicine which God, the physician, prescribes. Affliction has its light side as well as its dark one. God can sweeten our afflictions and candy our wormwood. As our sufferings abound, so does also our consolation, 2 Corinthians 1:5. Argyrius dated his letters from the pleasant garden of the Leonine prison. God sometimes so revives his children in trouble that they had rather bear their afflictions than want their comforts or lack their comforts. Why then, so they would rather bear the affliction than not have comforts. Why then should Christians entertain such hard thoughts of afflictions? Do not look at its grim face, but at the message it brings, which is to enrich us with both grace and comfort. Number two, if Israel be sometimes in the house of bondage in an afflicted state, think beforehand of affliction. Think beforehand of it. Say not as Job 29:18, I shall die in my nest. In the house of mirth, think of the house of bondage. You that are now Naomi may be Mara, Ruth 1 verse 20. How quickly may the scene turn and the hyperbole of joy end in a catastrophe. All outward things are given to change. The forethoughts of affliction would make us sober and moderate in the use of lawful delight. It would cure a surfeit. Christ at a feast mentions his burial, a good antidote against the surfeit. The forethought of affliction would make us prepare for it. It would take us off the world. It would put us upon search of our evidences. We should see what oil we have in our lamps, what grace we can find, that we may be able to stand in the evil day. That soldier is imprudent who has his sword to whet when he is just going to fight. He who forecasts sufferings will have the shield of faith and the sword of the Spirit ready, that he may not be surprised. Number three, if afflictions come, let us labor to conduct ourselves wisely as Christians, that we may adorn our sufferings, that is, let us endure with patience. Take, my brethren, the prophets for an example of suffering, affliction, and patience, James 5, verse 10. Satan labors to take advantage of us in affliction by making us either faint or murmur. He blows the coals of passion and discontent and then warms himself at the fire. That's a good picture. Patience adorns sufferings. A Christian should say, as Jesus Christ did, Lord, not my will, but thy will be done. It is a sign the affliction is sanctified when the heart is brought to a sweet, submissive frame. God will then remove the affliction. He will take us out of the iron furnace. We may consider these words, which brought thee out of the house of bondage, either, number one, literally, or number two, spiritually and mystically. In the letter, I brought thee out of the house of bondage, that is, I delivered you out of the misery and servitude you sustained in Egypt, where you were in the iron furnace, so that's literally, spiritually and mystically, by which I brought thee out of the house of bondage, is a type of our deliverance by Christ from sin and hell. It's like a picture of it, or a shadow of it, or a picture of it, which is typology. Number one, literally, I brought thee out of the house of bondage, out of great misery and slavery in the iron furnace. The thing I note here is that though God brings his people sometimes into trouble, yet he will bring them out again. Israel was in the house of bondage, but at last was brought out. We shall endeavor to show, number one, that God does deliver out of trouble. Number two, in what manner. Number three, at what seasons. Number four, why he delivers. Number five, how the deliverances of the godly and the wicked out of trouble differ. God does deliver his children out of troubles. Our fathers trusted in thee, they trusted, and thou didst deliver them. Psalm 22:4. And I was delivered out of the mouth of the lion, namely from Nero, 2 Timothy 4:17. Thou laidst affliction upon our loins, but thou broughtest us out into a wealthy place. Psalm 66:11-12. Weeping may endure for a night, but joy cometh in the morning. Psalm 30:5. God brought David out of the lion's den, Zion out of Babylon, and in his due time he gives an issue out of trouble. Psalm 68:20. The tree which in the winter seems dead revives in the spring. The sun emerges after the storms. Affliction may leap on us as the viper did on Paul, but at last it shall be shaken off. It is called a cup of affliction, Isaiah 51:17. The wicked drink a sea of wrath, the godly drink only a cup of affliction, and God will say shortly, let this cup pass away. God will give his people a delivery out of jail. Question, in what manner, so this is the next question, in what manner does God deliver his people out of trouble? He does it like a God in wisdom. Number one, he does it sometimes suddenly, as the angel was caused to fly swiftly, Daniel 9:21. So God sometimes makes a deliverance by fly swiftly, and on a sudden turns the shadow of death into the light of the morning. As he gives us mercies above what we can think, Ephesians 3:20, so sometimes before we can think of them. When the Lord turned again the captivity of Zion, we were like them that dream. It came suddenly upon us as a dream, Psalm 136:1. Joseph could not have thought of such a sudden alteration to be the same day freed out of prison and made the chief ruler in the kingdom. Mercy sometimes does not stick long in the birth, but comes forth on a sudden. Number two, God sometimes delivers his people strangely. Thus the whale, which swallowed up Jonah, was a means of bringing him safe to land. He sometimes delivers his people in the very way which they think will destroy. In bringing Israel out of Egypt, he stirred up the heart of the Egyptians to hate them, Psalm 105:25. And that was a means of their deliverance. He brought Paul to shore by a contrary wind and upon the broken pieces of the ship, Acts 27:44. Next question, when are the times and seasons that God usually delivers his people out of the bondage of affliction? Number one, when they are in the greatest extremity. Though Jonah was in the belly of hell, he says, thou hast brought up my life from corruption, Jonah 2:6. When there is but a hair's breadth between the godly and death, God ushers in deliverance. When the ship was almost covered with waves, Christ awoke and rebuked the wind. When Isaac was upon the altar and the life and the knife about to be put into his throat, the angel comes and says, lay not thy hand upon the child. When Peter began to sink, Christ took him by the hand. When the tail of the brick was doubled, then Moses, the temporal savior, came. When the people of God are in the greatest danger, the morning star of deliverance appears. When the patient is ready to faint, the cordial is given him. Number two, the second season is when affliction has done its work upon them, when it has effected that which God sent it for. As number one, when it has humbled them, remembering my affliction, the wormwood and gall, my soul is humbled in me, Lamentations 3:19-20. Then God's corrosive has eaten out the proud flesh. Number two, when it has tamed their impatience. Before, they were proud and impatient, like froward children that struggle with their parents. But when their cursed hearts are tamed, they say, I will bear the indignation of the Lord because I have sinned against him. Micah 7:9. And as Eli, it is the Lord, let him do what seemeth him good. Let him hedge me with thorns if he will plant me with grace. 1 Samuel 3:18. Number three, when they are partakers of more holiness and are more full of heavenly mindedness. Hebrews 12:10. When the sharp frost of affliction has brought forth the spring flowers of grace, the cross is sanctified, and God will bring them out of the house of bondage. Sorrow will turn to joy, ashes to garlands. When the metal is refined, it is taken out of the furnace. When affliction has healed us, God takes off the smarting plaster. The next question, why does God bring his people out of the house of bondage? Hereby he makes way, the answer, hereby he makes way for his own glory. His glory is dearer to him than anything besides. It is a crown jewel. By raising his people, he raises the trophies of his own honor. He glorifies his own attributes. His power, truth, and goodness are triumphant. Number one, his power. If God did not sometimes bring his people into trouble, how could his power be seen in bringing them out? He brought Israel out of the house of bondage with miracle upon miracle. He saved them with an outstretched arm. What ailed thee, O thou sea, that thou fleddest? Etc. Psalm 114, verse 5. Of Israel's march out of Egypt, it is said, when the sea fled and the waters were parted each from other. Here was the power of God set forth. Is there anything too hard for me? Jeremiah 32:27. God loves to help when things seem past hope. He creates deliverance, creates deliverance. Psalm 124, verse 8. He brought Isaac out of a dead womb and the Messiah out of a virgin's womb. Oh, how does his power shine forth when he overcomes seeming impossibilities and works a cure when things look desperate. Number two, his truth. God has made promises to his people when they are under great pressures to deliver them, and his truth is engaged in his promise. Call upon me in the day of trouble. I will deliver thee. Psalm 50, verse 15. He shall deliver thee in six troubles, yea, in seven. Job 5, 19. How is the scripture bespangled with these promises as the firmament is with stars? Either God will deliver them from death or by death. He will make a way of escape, 1 Corinthians 10:13. When promises are verified, God's truth is magnified. Number three, his goodness. God is full of compassion to such as are in misery. The Hebrew word rachem for mercy signifies bowels. God has sounding of bowels, Isaiah 63:15. And this sympathy stirs up God to deliver. In his love and pity he redeemed them, Isaiah 63, verse 9. This makes way for the triumph of his goodness. He is tender-hearted. He will not over-afflict. He cuts asunder the bars of iron. He breaks the yoke of the oppressor. Thus, all his attributes ride in triumph in saving his people out of trouble. Okay, I think we'll go ahead and stop there for this reading. And Lord willing, the next time we'll continue with the last question. How do the deliverance of the godly and the wicked differ? And then go on to the spiritual side of the words. And then that actually would finish the introduction section of the preface to the commandments. So, Lord willing, we'll plan to do that next time. But until then, go in God's graces, and Lord willing, we'll talk to you again soon.